Fatal Strategies by Jean Baudrillard. This is the last chapter, chapter 5, For a Principle of Evil. These fatal strategies, do they exist? I don't even feel that I've described them or even come close, not that the hypothesis is anything but a dream. So great is the sway of the real over the imagination. Where do you get what you say about the object? Objectivity is the opposite of fatality. The object is real, and real is subject to law, period. And so, faced with a delirious world, there is only the ultimatum of realism. This means that if you want to get away from the madness of the world, you have to sacrifice all of its charm as well. The world, in augmenting its delirium, has only raised the ante on sacrifice, blackmailed by the real. Today, illusion no longer counts. In order to survive, we need to approach ever closer to the nullity of the real. There is perhaps one fatal strategy, and only one, theory. And doubtless, the only difference between a banal theory and a fatal theory is that in one strategy, the subject still believes himself to be more cunning than the object, whereas in the other, the object is considered more cunning, cynical, talented than the subject, for which it lies in wait. The metamorphoses, the ruses, the strategies of the object surpass the subject's understanding. The object is neither the double nor the repressed of the subject, neither its fantasy nor its hallucination, neither its mirror nor its reflection. It has its own strategy and holds the key to the rules of a game, impenetrable trouble to the subject, not because they are deeply mysterious, but because they are infinitely ironic. It is objective irony that lies in wait for us, the irony of the fulfillment of the object, without regard for the subject or its alienation. In the phase of alienation, it is subjective irony that triumphs. It is the subject that constitutes an insoluble challenge to the blind world that surrounds him. Subjective irony, ironic subjectivity, is the essence of a world of interdiction, law, and desire. The power of the subject lies in its promise of fulfillment, whereas the sphere of the object is the order of what has been fulfilled, and from which, for this very reason, it is impossible to escape. We confuse the fatal with the return of the repressed, what is inescapable is desire, but the order of fatality is antithetical to that of repression. What is inescapable is not desire, but the ironic presence of the object, its indifference and indifferent connections, its challenge, its seduction, and its disobedience to the symbolic order, and therefore also of the subject's unconscious, if he had one. What is inescapable, in a word, is the principle of evil. The subject obeys our metaphysics, which has always tried to distill good and evil. The object, however, is translucent to evil. That is why it shows, mischievously, diabolically, its voluntary servitude, bends willingly, like nature, to any law we impose upon it, and disobeys all legislation. And when I speak of the object and its profound duplicity, I speak of all of us and our political and social order. The whole problem of voluntary servitude should be re-examined in this light, not to resolve it, but to sound out the enigma. Obedience, in effect, is a banal strategy, which doesn't need to be explained, for it secretly contains, all obedience secretly contains, a fatal disobedience to the symbolic order. This is how a principle of evil exists, not as a mystical process and transcendence, but as a hideout for the symbolic order, as the theft, the rape, the receiving of stolen goods, and the ironic embezzlement of the symbolic order. This is how the object is transparent due to the principle of evil. Unlike the subject, it is a poor conductor of the symbolic order, but a good conductor of the fatal, that is to say, of a pure objectivity, sovereign and incorrigible, imminent and enigmatic. Furthermore, it is not evil that is interesting, it's the spiral of worsening. For the subject clearly reflects, to its dismay, the evil principle in its mirror, but the object wants to be worse, and demands the worst. It is proof of a more radical negativity, namely, that if everything finally disobeys the symbolic order, it's because everything was subverted from the very beginning. Even before being produced, the world was seduced. a strange procession which today still weighs on all of reality. The world has been refuted at its source, so it is impossible for it ever to be verified. Negativity, whether historical or subjective, is nothing. The truly diabolical, even in thought, is original subversion. Opposed to the utopia of the Last Judgment, complementary to that of the original baptism, we find the vertigo of simulation, the Luciferian rapture of the eccentricity of the beginning and the end. This is why the gods can only live and hide in the inhuman, in objects and animals, in the sphere of silence and objective brutishness, and not in the sphere of man, which is that of language and subjective brutishness. The God-man is an absurdity. A god who rejects the ironic mask of the inhuman, who emerges from the bestial metaphor, from the objective metamorphosis where he incarnated in silence the principle of evil in order to don a soul and a face, assumes at the same time the hypocritical psychology of the human. We need to be respectful of the inhuman. This is the way of certain cultures, which we call fatalist, as a way of condemning them without trial, because they found their commandments on the side of the inhuman, on the side of the stars, or of an animal god, of constellations, or faceless divinities. A grand choice, that of a faceless divinity. Nothing is less like our own modern and technical iconolatry. Metaphysics only allows good rays to filter in, and wants to make the world into the mirror of the subject, who has already passed through the mirror phase. Metaphysics wants a world of forms distinct from their doubles, their shadows, their images. This is the principle of the good. But the object is always the fetish, the false, the feticho, the factitious, the lure, everything that incarnates the abominable confusion of the thing with its magical and artificial double, and that no religion of transparency and the mirror will ever be able to resolve. That is the principle of evil. When I speak of the object and its fatal strategies, I'm speaking also of people and their inhuman strategies. For example, a human being can find in a vacation a greater boredom than in everyday life, a redoubled boredom, because it is made up of all the elements of happiness and distraction. The important point is the predestination of vacations to boredom, the bitter and triumphal foreboding that there is no escaping this. How could we suppose that people were going to disavow their daily life and look for an alternative to it? On the contrary, they'll make a destiny out of it. Intensify it while seeming to do the opposite. Plunge into it to the point of ecstasy. Seal the monotony of it with an even greater monotony. This hyper-banality is the equivalent of fatality. If one doesn't understand this, then one understands nothing of this collective brutishness, which is a grand act of self-surpassing. I'm not joking. People are not looking for amusement. Instead, they want to find a fatal distraction. Boredom is not the problem. And the essential point is the increase of boredom. Increase is salvation and ecstasy. It could mean the ecstatic deepening of anything, even the increase of oppression and abjection that works like the liberating ecstasy of abjection, just as the absolute commodity works like the liberating forms of the commodity. This is the only solution to the problem of quote-unquote voluntary servitude. Furthermore, there is no liberation but this one, the deepening of negative conditions. All forms that tend to project a dazzling and miraculous liberty are only revolutionary homilies. Liberating logic is basically understood only by a few. Essentially, it is fatal logic that wins out. Another form of fundamental cynicism, this will to spectacle and illusion, opposed to all will for knowledge and power, tenacious, deep in a man's heart, it haunts nonetheless the process of events. There is, as it were, a drive for pure event, objective information, the most secret facts and thoughts, to be commuted into spectacle, to attain ecstasy in a scene instead of being pronounced as something really happening. To occur is necessary, to be in ecstasy is absolutely vital. Things can only happen in this excessive manner, that is to say, not in the hold of representation, but in the magic of their effect. There only they appear great and do themselves the luxury of existing. We think of nature as indifferent, and certainly is to the passions and enterprises of man, but it isn't perhaps indifferent to the fact of making a spectacle of itself in natural disasters. This is something of a parable, but it's here only to signify this passion of passions, stimulating passion, seductive passion, subversive passion, that means that things are meaningless unless transfigured by this illusion, this derision, this production which is not at all a representation, but their prodigious and eccentric form, the will to disdain their causes and to lose ourselves in their effects, and particularly in the effects of their disappearance. Prodigious form that moralists have always condemned, for here is where things, cynically, subvert themselves from their beginnings and their ends, in a distant echo of original sin. Furthermore, it is this eccentricity that protects us from the real and its disastrous consequences. That things exhaust themselves in their spectacle, in a magic and artificial fetishism, is the distortion that serious minds will always oppose in their utopian expurgation of the world, in order to deliver it exact, intact, and authentic for the day of last judgment. But this spectacle that the moralists disapprove of is possibly the lesser evil. For God knows where unleashed meaning would lead to when it refuses to produce itself as appearance. Even revolution can only happen if its spectacle is possible. What the quote-unquote beautiful souls deplore is that the media are putting an end to the real event. But if we consider the problem of nuclear annihilation, we may realize the possibility that it is its distillation in simulated everyday panic, in the haunting and spectacular thrills that the media treat our fears to, that protects us from the nuclear clash, and not the balance of terror. There is no strategic guarantee in deterrence, nor, furthermore, any survival instinct in the species. What protects us is that, for nuclear holocaust, the event threatens dangerously to deny us all hope of spectacle. That is why it won't happen. Humanity can accept its own physical disappearance, but it cannot accept to sacrifice its spectacle, unless it succeeds in finding a spectator in another world. The drive to spectacle is more powerful than the survival instinct. We can count on that. If the morality of things lies in their sacrosanct use value, then long live the immortality of the atom and of nuclear arms, which cause even them to be submitted to the ultimate and cynical event of the spectacle. Long live the secret rule of the game that causes everything to disobey the symbolic law. What will save us is neither the rational principle nor use value. Rather, it's the immoral principle of the spectacle, the ironic principle of evil. Absorption in this secondary effect is a kind of passion and a kind of fatal will. Likewise, no life can be conceived of outside the framework of a second chance. The design of a life cannot be given except by the vibrant certainty of a necessary return, sooner or later, a little like the resurrection of the body but without the last judgment, the reappearance of certain moments or faces that have once been. These will come back, for they can only disappear on the horizon of your life, whose trajectory, subverted precisely by events, takes the unconscious curve necessary to give them the chance of a second life or of a definitive return. Then only will they really have taken place. Then only they'll have been lost or won. Footnote. Of course, this is not the spectacle that the situations denounced as the acme of alienation and the ultimate limit of capitalism. Neither would it be instead the opposite, since here it is a matter of the victorious strategy of the object, its own mode of subversion, and not a way in which it is subverted. We would be much closer, in fact, with the charm of the commodity in Baudelaire. End of footnote. From a certain moment on, these second comings comprise the very design of his existence, where consequently nothing happens by chance. It's the first coming, which is not meaningful in itself and loses itself in the banal obscurity of living, that happens by chance. Only by redoubling can it make of itself a true event, attaining the character of a fatal happening. It's like an astrological sign that is meaningful only when accompanied by its ascendant. The sign itself is nothing. Accompanied, it becomes ineluctable. Once certain events of a life have thus had their second chance, once the cycle has brought them back once and once only, that life is completed. When a life knows no second coming of this kind, it ends before having begun. The fatal is there somewhere, in that direction. In this sense, the old heresies were right. Everyone has the right to a second birth, the true one. Everyone is predestined, not by astral decree, but by internal immanence in our own life, to the necessary return of such events. That is why, chance having been abolished, the Last Judgment is useless. This is why the theory of predestination is infinitely superior to that of freedom of the soul. Predestination eliminates from life all that is only destined. All that, having happened only once, is only accidental, while what happens a second time becomes fatal. But it also gives to life the intensity of these secondary events, which have, as it were, the depth of a previous existence. There is neither form nor meaning to a first encounter, still strained with misunderstanding and banality. Fatality only comes afterwards, by the current effect of this previous life. And there is a sort of will and energy in this occurrence, which no one knows anything about, and which isn't the resurgence of a hidden order. Not at all. It's in the full light of day that certain things come to their assigned existence. If the stars rose and set in just any order, heaven itself would be meaningless. It's the recurrence of their trajectory that makes for the heavenly event, and it's the recurrence of certain fatal peripeties that make for the event of a life. At the end of all that, if the object is ingenious, if the object is fatal, what can we do about it? After the art of survival, the ironic art of disappearance? The subject has always dreamed of this, a dream inverse to its dream of totalization, and the one has never been able to erase the other. Quite the contrary. Its failure today awakens passions that are much more subtle. At the heart of banal strategies is the fiery desire of fatal strategies. Nothing can guarantee us a fatality, even less a strategy. What is more, the conjunction of these two terms is paradoxical. How could there be fatality if there is strategy? That's just the point. The enigma is that fatality is at the heart of every strategy. It's what peeks through the heart of more banal strategies. It's the object, whose fatality would be a strategy something like the rule of another game. Basically, the object mocks the laws we attach to it. It would rather figure in our calculations as a sarcastic variable, and leave it to the equations to verify themselves. But the rules of the game, the conditions according to which it accepts playing, no one knows them, and they can change without notice. No one knows what a strategy is. There are not enough means in the world for us to be able to dispose of ends. And therefore, I'm going to read that again. There are not enough means in the world for us to be able to dispose of ends. And therefore, no one is capable of articulating a final process. God himself is forced to employ a trial-and-error method. The interesting thing about this is the inexorable logical process that is visible here, by which the object is taken into the very game that we wanted to make it play, doubling the ante somehow, escalating the bidding on the strategic limits it will tolerate, instilling thereby a strategy that doesn't have its own ends, a playful strategy that stills the play of the subject, a fatal strategy in that the subject thereby succumbs to the surpassing of its own objectives. We are accomplishing in this excess of finality that is there in the object. This can be the excess of meaning, and therefore the impossibility of deciphering a word that plays the game of meaning all too well. We invent all these strategies in the hope of having them result in the unexpected event. The real we invent wholly in the hope of seeing it result in a prodigious artifice. From any object we hope for a blind response that hampers our projects. From strategy we expect control. From seduction we look for surprise. Seduction is fatal. It's the effect of a sovereign object that recreates you in you an original confusion and seeks to surprise you. Fatality, in turn, is seductive, like the discovery of a hidden rule. The discovery of a hidden rule of the game is dazzling and compensates us in advance for the cruelest losses. Likewise with the joke. If I look for a fatal connection in language, I fall on the joke, which is itself the denouement of language immanent to language. That is the fatal, the same sign presiding over a life's crystallization and its resolution at the knotting of the intrigue and its denouement. and language become pure object, irony is the objective form of this denouement. Everywhere, as in the wits, redoubling and escalating the stakes are spirited forms of denouement. Everything must unfold in a fatal and ingenious way, just as everything was caught from the start in an original subversion. Even predestination is a form of ironic subversion of fatality. Chance is also one. What's the use of trying to establish chance as an objective process if it is an ironic one? Of course it exists, but against all science, in the irony of the aleatory, and even at the molecular level. And of course fatality exists too, simultaneously. There's no paradox involved in this. The difference is that the irony of fatality is greater than the irony of chance, which just makes it more tragic and more seductive. It's true that this is a difficult and obscure route, to side with the object, to take up the cause of the object, to find another rule, another axiom. Nothing mystical in this, nothing of the otherworldly delirium of a subjectivity trapped and escaping headlong into a paroxysmal inventory. But simply to delineate this other logic, unravel those other strategies, leave the field open to objective irony. That is also a challenge. Eventually, it threatens absurdity and runs the risk of what it describes, but the risk is to be taken. The hypothesis of a fatal strategy must itself be fatal too. If there be a morality, it too must be engaged in the eccentric cycle of its effects, must itself be hypermoral, like the real is hyperreal, must be no longer a moral stasis, but a moral ecstasy, must itself be a special effect. Levi-Strauss claimed that the symbolic order had left us, yielding to history. Today, says Canetti, history itself has withdrawn. What remains but to pass on the side of the object, and on the side of its eccentric and precious effects, of its fatal effects? Fatality is only the absolute liberty of effects. Semiurge. It's like semiotics and hemorrhage. Today, now that all critical radicality has become useless, now that all negativity seems resolved in a world that pretends to realize itself, and now that the critical spirit has found its summer home in socialism, and the effects of desire are largely depleted, what remains but to bring things back to their enigmatic ground zero? Now the enigma is inverted. Once it was the Sphinx that posed men the question of man, the question Oedipus thought he answered, that we all thought we answered. Today it's man that poses to the Sphinx, the inhuman, the question of the inhuman, of the fatal, of the indifference of the world toward our affairs, of its fickleness toward objective laws. The object, the Sphinx, subtler than man, hardly answers. But it's certain nevertheless that in disobeying laws, in unraveling desire, it answers secretly to some enigma. What remains but to side with this enigma? Everything can be summed up in this. Let's believe, for a single instant, the hypothesis that there is a fatal and enigmatic bias in the order of things. In any case, there's something stupid about our current situation. There's something stupid in the raw event, to which destiny, if it exists, could not be insensible. There's something stupid in the current forms of truth and objectivity that a superior irony could spare us. Everything is expiated in one way or another. Everything is headed somewhere. Truth only complicates things. And if the last judgment consists, as everyone knows, for each of us, in saving and eternalizing a moment of our lives, and only one, one only, with whom do we share this ironic end?